Our Father in heaven, we thank you for this day that we can come before your holy presence to worship you together as your people. We rejoice that we can worship you together with brethren in different parts of the world. And we pray that you will be with them, bless them, guide them, even as we ask that you'll be in our midst, that you'll guide us in our time of worship, that you also have the freedom to speak to us. Father, we thank you for creating us in your image with the potential to live lives that are deep, rich, and meaningful, with the capacity to learn, to grow, to know you deeply, to have deep fellowship with you, to have a meaningful part in our working of your purposes. We ask that you will continue to help us to understand what is in your heart, how you have created us, what you desire and require of us, our need to respond positively to your high calling, and that we are accountable for our lives. We entrust this time to your hands, and we pray that you will help us to be clear about the issues that are important, in particular our recognition of our ability to make moral choices and the implications that are involved. All this we ask and pray with thanksgiving in Jesus' name. Amen. We continue with our consideration of the subject of the fulfillment of God's purposes, the 15th message. We continue with the subject of the topic of ability to make moral choices, the second message. Ability to make moral choices, the second message. That God has created man in his image with a capacity to recognize and choose between good and evil and make moral choices, and the ability to choose other than what he has chosen. And the subtopic for today, countering the view that we are not able to choose other than what we actually choose. Countering the view that we are not able to choose other than what we actually choose. In the last message, I considered with you the importance of being clear about this capacity and ability in men to make moral choices and the ability to choose other than what we actually choose, and also spend some time to show that this is the clear teaching and revelation in the scriptures. I mentioned it's important to be clear about this capacity in men because it is an integral aspect of man created by God as a moral being, and man created by God as a moral being is a vital aspect of being created in the image of God, and our understanding of the fundamental truths, various areas of truth that are fundamental to the Christian faith revealed in the scriptures, hinges on our appreciation of the reality and meaning of this capacity in man, and also the implications. And it's important for us to be clear about this area because there are those who say we are not able to choose other than what we actually choose, or hold positions that clearly has this implication. And it includes those who are intellectually able and influential, including philosophers and theologians, and that this notion that we are not able to choose other than what we actually choose would hinder and distort understanding of the various major areas of truth pertaining to how God has created us, what God requires of us, and how we should live. In particular, the whole issue of man's responsibility and accountability for his life, and how man learns and grows in moral spiritual stature, understanding how God relates with us, understanding ourselves and others, and how to we can meaningfully fulfill our part in the working of God's purposes. To be able to appreciate all these truths properly, we need to have a clear understanding and appreciation of the reality and meaning of man's capacity to choose and make moral choices and ability to choose other than what we have actually chosen. Today I want to examine this area more carefully. On the one hand, it may seem to us ridiculous and wholly untenable to deny man's ability to choose other than what he has chosen, because we all know that we can choose other than what we have chosen at any point in time. Even right now, we know we can choose to continue to sit here or to leave this place. We can choose what we want to eat, what we want to dress, which dress we want to put on, and so many different alternatives are available to us, and we are conscious that we can't choose amongst various alternatives. We have also seen that it is a clear scriptural teaching, it's also a foundational truth on which various major truths and teachings in the scriptures hinges, and also is the basis on which we live our daily lives and how society functions. All this we have seen in the last message. On the other hand, there are points and arguments that can be put forward for the proposition that we will not choose other than what we actually choose, that we will choose what we will choose, what we actually choose. Which, and these points and arguments that are put forward can seem rather convincing and difficult to refute. They can come in many different forms, but I intend to concentrate on two major lines of thinking. Today I want to concentrate on one of them. A major line of thinking under the heading cause and effect and reasons for our choices. Cause and effect and reasons for our choices. So bear in mind, this is a line of approach that's taken that can seem rather convincing, that we will not choose other than what we actually choose. Cause and effect. Modern man tends to think of occurrences in life and in the universe in terms of cause and effect. Whenever something occurs or takes place, there are reasons for it, there are causes for it. For example, why apples fall downwards instead of upwards. Many of you may be familiar with this story, whether it really happened this way. From what I recall, that Newton was sitting under the apple tree and the apple fell. I don't know whether it hit his head, and he began to wonder, why is it the apple fall downwards instead of upwards? And finally, he came up with this understanding of the pull of gravitation. So why is it apples fall downwards and not upwards? This reason for it is due to gravitational pull. And so there are many laws in nature that explains why things happen this way, that way, and so on. So whether it be apples falling downwards or why a person falls sick, there are reasons, there are causes for it. He has been infected, bacteria, virus, and so on, and we can examine. So the doctor examine, and there are reasons why this person falls sick, causes for the sickness. To why a person gets angry. Why he gets angry? Because someone makes him angry. There are reasons when someone provokes him, makes him angry. To why a person commits crime. You study. Why is it this person commits crime? So studies are made then you see it's due to his constitutional makeup, his upbringing, his environmental influences, and all the temptations and pressures at that point in time. So all these are the different reasons why he commits the crime. And the reasoning can go something like this. There are reasons why we respond in a certain way, why we choose a particular course of action. There are reasons. This applies to inanimate objects. It also applies to men. Why the apple falls downwards? And many other occurrences in nature that we observe, there are reasons. Likewise for men, when man chooses, there are reasons why a person responds in a certain way, why he chooses a particular course of action. There are reasons for his action, and those reasons account for why he chose that particular course of action. And he will not choose otherwise. These are the reasons, and so he will choose because of those reasons. As I go on, you'll see it becomes more complicated and become more and more sound rather convincing. At this point, you may say, this doesn't sound very convincing. There may be reasons, but can't I choose to do otherwise? Not only that, we may say that we are conscious that we can think, we can analyze, we can consider alternative causes of action, and then finally we arrive at a decision and we make a choice. There are alternatives, so it is not fixed. But the response would be, even our thought processes, our emotions, and the final decision we arrive at, there are reasons for the whole process. And because of the presence of those reasons, we will choose in that way. It will not be otherwise. A simple way of it, putting it in equation form, which I mentioned in the previous message, is constitution, that is our physical, our constitution, plus the influences and environment to which we are subjected, equals, or this gives rise to our response, our choice, our conduct. Constitution plus influences, environment, equals response, choice, conduct. You may say, do people really think like that? Well, some of us may have come across reports, read about this debate, about the nature and nurture debate, which is an attempt to apportion the proportion of causal weight to account for the development of a person and the outcome of his life. Now, this may sound a little bit difficult. I explain what I mean. The nature nurture debate, they are trying to say how much weight should we give to nature, then how much weight to nurture when we try to understand how a person has developed and the outcome of his life. What is the percentage? 30, 70, 40, 60? What is it? And nature is basically man's constitution at birth. Nurture is basically the surrounding circumstances and the various influences on the person, including his upbringing and so on. All the influences upon the person. And in various of these discussions, the significance of the person's choice is often not even mentioned or considered. That is, nature plus nurture adds up to 100%. Nature plus nurture gives rise to development of the person and the outcome of his life. Some seem to adopt this kind of approach. I say seem because I do not want to conclude, but it seems to be like that in some of these reports that we read. Now, if this is the approach, it is fundamentally flawed. And this would appear to be a reflection of the line of thinking that I mentioned just now. Constitution plus influences, environment equals response, choice, conduct. But I now want to go on further with the line of thinking I was saying just now. This illustration of nurture and nature debate is just an illustration that is not so far-fetched. And in fact, this line of thinking that I'm going to bring forward, some may not state it in such strong terms, but there are those who actually think along these lines, as I mentioned, who are intellectually able. But in different forms, man's thinking, many people have been influenced by this kind of thinking without being very conscious of the implications, what it means. I want to elaborate now of this point about reasons for our conduct, our response, our decisions, our choices. As I said, we may counter by saying that but we do analyze, we do think, and the alternative choices. But the response is that although there are alternative causes of action, there must be reasons for us to choose what we choose at any particular moment of time. And because of those reasons, we will choose what we actually choose, which means we will not choose other than what we actually choose, meaning our sense that we can choose otherwise is an illusion. For example, your decision to be here today, you may say, I could choose not to be here. Well, there are reasons why you are here today. And because of those reasons, you are here. But you may say, I could have chosen not to be present. And in reality, you could have done it. And there are those who may not be present here today. So it's possible for a person to be present or not to be present. But if you say you could have chosen not to be present, the response would be, if you had chosen not to be present, there would have been reasons for that. And because of those reasons, you won't be present. Well, you may say, well, if you say that there are reasons why I'm here, okay, now I'm here, and I cannot choose otherwise, I will deliberately show you I can. So I will walk out. I refuse to be present. Now, if you do that, it's because you are provoked by this idea that you cannot choose otherwise. So you want to prove it, you make yourself absent. Now, that again is a reason why you finally walk out. So, because your mind works in that way, you move. So you still will choose what you choose, and you will not choose otherwise. If you still find it not so easy to follow, I'll go on further. But in the end, even if you cannot follow this whole thing through, which is not so easy in some parts, so long as in your heart you are very clear that you can choose, and it is not true, you cannot choose other than what you actually choose, that is good enough. But as I've mentioned, people can be affected. Not just directly by this point that I'm not able to choose other than what I actually choose, but things that we hear, books that we read, articles that we come across, can at times confuse us, and we may not even be aware that we are being influenced by thoughts, ideas that at the underlying part of it is fundamentally flawed. If we are clear of the biblical position that we actually can choose, and there are alternatives, and we could have chosen differently. Now, as I go on, I think it may become clearer to you why this line of thinking can appear quite convincing. Along this line of thinking, the whole process of our choices and even our thought processes, our response, everything within the man, in our response and thinking and analysis and so on, and the choices that we make, the whole process can be traced right back to the moment we are conceived. All our responses and choices since the moment we are conceived, all along the way until the outcome of our lives, all this can be accounted for. Why is this so? Because from the moment of conception, then the development of the fetus, our constitution at birth, the surrounding circumstances, the influences along the way. I'll go step by step. For example, there would be reasons for our response and the way we choose since we come into this world, and it would include our constitution at birth. This would include genetic, physical, mental, emotional makeup. Then there will be the framework surrounding circumstances affecting, influencing us from the moment of conception. I say from the moment of conception because I didn't say from the moment of birth, because there's indication. There are those who say, even from in the womb already, you can already be affected. So from the moment you can be affected, your constitution, and then all the various influences that affects you. And this would include the surrounding circumstances, influences would include the historical, geographical, social, and cultural context, the country of birth, the sex, your sex when you're born, your parents, your siblings, the people you come into contact, the school you go to, the friends you have, the experiences you go through, the things you see and hear and read. All this will influence you and they will act on your constitution. So the interplay between all these various influences and your constitution will result in the responses within you and your thought processes, and finally the decisions that you make. Why do you choose this way or that way? There are reasons for it. Interplay of these influences on your constitution, and then you act. Well, for non-believers, it will be like this. But for believers, you may say, but that's not all. What about God at work? What about the powers of darkness at work? Well, there are believers. Believers, in our context, would mean Christians, because there can also be those who believe in God, but they are not Christians. But even Christians, the line of thinking would then move further, and that would be God at work and the powers of darkness at work will be part of the influences on us that gives rise to the final decision. But even before the final decision, the thought processes, the emotions, and so on, all this comes about because of the interaction between the influences and the constitution. So the response, the thought processes, the emotion, the analysis, even how we analyze things, and then the final choices that we make. So we will finally make a decision. But that decision will be a result of interplay of all these things. So the final decision we made, and it will be that decision. It won't be otherwise. How can it be otherwise? Well, you consider, how can it be otherwise? So how we feel, think, reason things out, how we respond and choose at any moment of time would be due to a combination of all these various factors at work. There are reasons why we feel, why we think, why we choose the way we do. And we will think, feel, choose what we actually feel, think, choose. It cannot be otherwise. So the ability to choose other than what we actually choose is an illusion. We may feel that we could choose otherwise, But we will not choose otherwise. To some degree, as a Christian, we look at it, it may also seem quite reasonable. Because whether in the end you choose to wake up in the morning to do your quiet time, as you consider, you know there are good reasons why you should, so you will do it. So you will do it. And if you don't, because you're lazy, well, that is a reason. So because, although you think you should, you know you should, but you feel lazy, you feel tired, so you rather not get up. So there are reasons again, so you don't. So whichever course of action you take, there are reasons for it. And so you will act in that way, in the way you actually act. I just trace a little of the development of this line of thinking in according to my own understanding in my readings. It seems to me this kind of thinking has become more influential with what many may term as the modern age. That is, with the birth and development of modern science and what is known as the scientific approach. That everything can be explained by science and cause and effect. With the development of modern science, the scientific approach, men more and more began to think of things in terms of cause and effect. Everything has cause and effect. And there's what is known as scientific approach. And that is reality. And that's being rational. That is part of being modern, up to date. So everything can be explained by science and cause and effect. And this leads to the idea of what I will term, and what I, from my understanding, my readings, there are people who also use this term, of what is known as a closed universe. A closed universe in this sense that there's no place for miracles, supernatural input, intervention, or some people. And this leads to what sometimes is termed as scientific determinism. Determinism means it's determined. Scientific determinism, that is, all the occurrences in the universe, they are all fixed because they all, whatever occurs, there are reasons for it. You can trace backwards. And whatever occurs will occur because of the reasons that are present. So the apple will fall at that moment of time. If you trace back, there are reasons. It's ripe. Why is it ripe? Somebody earlier planted the tree. And there's the weather and so on that enables it to grow. So at that particular moment of time, it will drop and so on. So everything that occurs, there are reasons for it, cause and effect. Those who subscribe to the idea of a closed universe includes those who deny the existence of God, as well as those who believe in the existence of God. Now you may say this sounds rather strange. How can those who believe in God believe in a closed universe? But this is actually the general position of what is normally termed the liberal theologians or modern theology. Liberal or modern theology. In this system of thought, there is a belief in God, that God exists, but they do not believe in miracles taking place. Why? They say all things, all occurrences take place within the framework of physical laws of nature ordained by God. So they can believe that there's no, that it is what I termed just now, the closed universe. So everything takes place within the framework of the laws of nature, because God has created the universe with physical laws of nature ordained by God, and all things, all occurrences take place within this framework. Those who subscribe to the idea of a closed universe would say that this is the basis for scientific studies, because Otherwise, how do you study science? Science is possible because they are ordained laws, physical laws of nature. Even those who do not believe in God, they believe they are laws. The laws of nature. And because there are these laws of nature, we can then study science. We can observe and then formulate these laws. And we can talk about laws of physics, like law of gravity, then there are laws of chemistry and so on. There's an order. There's a consistency in the reality of that occurs in the universe. And it is this that enables us to plan and to order our lives, or even to use the so many appliances that now we take for granted. Pause for a while, is it not so? Now we take for granted, we go home, we switch on the lights, just as we come here, we can switch on the lights. We switch on, we push the switch, and we expect the light to come on. But this is not feasible if the laws of physics do not exist, if it's haphazard. You may keep pushing, but no light comes on. Maybe you push a million times, one time it comes on, because it's haphazard. Of course, you may say, but sometimes I push and it doesn't come on. Now, it doesn't come on doesn't mean the laws of physics are not operating. It's operating, but perhaps there's something wrong with your switch. So it is not haphazard. It works consistently. The laws of physics consistently operates. Chemistry, so on. The laws of nature operates consistently. That is why we can make appliances. That is why we can drive a car. You can turn on the switch and the engine will come on. There are so many things in life that are very, very complex that all hinges on the consistency of these laws operating. Otherwise, we may have difficulty even to take a walk. Because you realize that those who try to walk on the moon is very different from on the earth. Because there, the gravitational pull is different. So if the laws of physics, of gravitational pull, is not consistent, then we try to walk, we may one moment be flying, one moment be colliding with something else. We cannot even walk properly. So whether it be switching on the lights, or cooking a meal, or using appliances, or even just walking, all this rests on the consistencies of all these physical laws of nature. So all things take place within this framework of physical laws of nature. Such people also tend to think, those who subscribe to the views of the closed universe, they tend to think that those who believe in miraculous supernatural intervention, that such thinking is backward, unscientific, and they may think that it is incredible that a modern person can still believe in such things, that these are ideas and concepts of primitive people who are superstitious, and they will then classify many things they do not understand as miraculous. Because you're superstitious, you're backward, so many things you don't understand, you say it's miraculous. It's a supernatural occurrence. But they will say, in reality, there are no miracles, and modern science is able to explain everything, and increasingly able to explain even what is termed as miraculous occurrences in scientific terms. In fact, their position would be all such occurrences can be explained in scientific terms if we have sufficient knowledge. It's just that we haven't found out the answer yet. Well, this is just a bit of a background as to how some of these things develop, but I want to make this observation, this note, that the discussion on whether man can choose other than what he actually chooses actually goes beyond whether the person believes in the existence of God and miraculous supernatural occurrences. That is, even if a person recognizes the existence of God and that there can be miraculous supernatural intervention by God, supernatural miraculous occurrences do take place, that the issue that we are considering is still this. Is it feasible for man to choose other than what he actually chooses, even with the belief in God and his working in our lives? How can this be feasible, even with the recognition that God does work in many ways, including in the hearts and minds of men? Even if you recognize this, we agree that it is true. God can work in many ways. He can work in our hearts and in our minds. But the thing is, even if this is true, and we believe this is true, but the argument can still be put forward. Even if this is true, we believe this is true, how do you explain that man can choose other than what he actually chooses? Is it feasible? Well, you may say, God can influence, God can help the person to make a better choice so that he refrains from the evil act he would otherwise have done. So, as a result, he didn't do the evil thing, so he has chosen other than what he otherwise would have chosen because of God helping him. Or you can say others helping him, praying for him, and so on. But the reply would be, there would still be reasons for him to choose the way he does. So God working in his life in this way merely adds to the totality of the influences upon him and the reasons for his response and conduct. So the total framework and circumstances surrounding him at that point in time would now include God working in his life, resulting in him choosing the way he does. So there will still be reasons for him to choose the way he does, and he still will not choose other than what he actually chooses. And this may sound quite reasonable. So, yes, the person wants to move that way, but because God worked in his heart, so he could see, yes, I should choose otherwise. And God strengthened him, encouraged him, and so he will now choose otherwise. But he will then choose that way. So the same reasoning goes for people praying for him and any other factor that you can think of that would influence his ultimate choice. And that includes the powers of darkness at work. So this leads to what some people, the expression they sometimes use, whatever will be, will be. Whatever you will choose, you will choose. One brief observation at this point of our consideration of this subject. There are those who believe that total reality consists only of matter, substance. And if this were so, then man also consists of matter, atoms, molecules. And there are those who have this kind of understanding of life, of reality in this universe. Everything consists only of matter. There's nothing else. It's only matter, molecules, atoms. So man also consists of matter, atoms, molecules. And those who subscribe to the reality of the universe consisting only of matter, and man being consisting only of matter, atoms, molecules, will then have this line of thinking that the thought life, the emotions, and what we think are the choices and the decisions we make, resulting in our conduct, our actions, that these are merely the result of chemical reactions in the body. How the atoms interact, how the molecules interact, and as a result, you'll have your emotions, and as a result, your thought processes, and as a result, you'll make your choices. So all this, if it's explained in this way, this will be in line with what I mentioned just now about science and the scientific method, the scientific approach, cause and effect. So the final decision, action, can be traced back to the chemical reactions in the body, in the mind, and so on. All this. So because of the way the molecules, the atoms in the person moves and interacts, and the thought processes, the results, the emotions, the decisions will arise, and that will be the decision. So the so-called freedom of choice, the capacity to choose other than what we actually choose, is an illusion. We feel we can choose otherwise, but it's only an illusion. And if you think about it, it can be difficult to avoid this conclusion for those who do not believe in the existence of God and who believe that total reality consists only of matter. Although this line of thinking seems so strange, it is actually quite logical to think like that if, in fact, total reality consists only of matter. Well, just now I've already mentioned about the line of thinking about nurture and nature debate, so I will not repeat that here. What then is the Christian response? How can we respond to what has been considered above? The arguments put forward, the line of thinking that seems to give rise to the idea that we cannot choose other than what we have actually chosen. Well, in relation to the Christian response, the biblical position, the ultimate truth and reality, we have seen in the previous message, it is that man can make moral choices. Man can choose other than what he actually chooses, and he will be held accountable for his moral response and choices. That is the clear biblical position. That is also reality and truth. And in the last message, I mentioned to you 4 points. The first point is that this is the clear teaching and revelation of the scriptures, and I spent some time to consider this with you. The second point I mentioned is the personal consciousness of this area of truth, that we have the capacity to choose, and we have the capacity to choose other than what we have chosen. It's a clear consciousness in each one of us. It's an axiomatic truth, self-evident. Just like our consciousness that we exist, we know we can choose, we know we can choose other than what we have chosen. We have this capacity. To deny it is almost like denying we exist. There's this consciousness in man. And the third point I mentioned is that this consciousness is not peculiar to yourself. It's a consciousness that's universal. People all over the world can recognize there's this consciousness of the capacity to choose and ability to choose other than what you have chosen. And fourthly, that all societies function on the understanding that man is a moral being with a capacity to choose, and the various concepts of blameworthiness, praiseworthiness, punishment, reward, whether a person deserves the punishment or not, whether it's fair, it's just to punish a person that way and so on. And all the encouragement, exhortations to be responsible, to be disciplined, to be careful, and condemnation, rebuke for being irresponsible, reckless, ill-disciplined, wrongdoing, and so on. And that it's wrong to blame, to reprimand, to condemn, punish someone for something he cannot choose to do otherwise. These are universally recognized by people of different cultures, different historical, geographical contexts. And God has created us this way with also this consciousness to recognize that we can choose, we can make alternative decisions, we can choose other than what we have actually chosen. Well, this is the background that we have already covered in the last message. But the issue now is this. How can it be so? How is it possible for us to choose other than what we actually choose? Is it so? What about the arguments that have been put forward? The cause and effect, the reasons for our choices and our thought processes and so on? Before I go on to my understanding of how this can be so, I want to make a preliminary remark first. That it is feasible, it is reasonable for a believer to recognize that we can choose, we can make choices other than what we actually choose. We can recognize and believe that this is so, even if we can't explain it. Not that there's no explanation, but even if you can't explain it, it doesn't mean that we cannot believe this. So, based on the 4 points that I have raised, to me, it is very reasonable for a Christian to believe that. First, if we are satisfied, it's very clear, a clear teaching in the scriptures that is sufficient for us. But this is very strongly backed by the consciousness of an axiomatic truth that's self-evident. The consciousness that we exist, the consciousness that we can. Not in a blur kind of sense. It's very clear we have this consciousness, we know very clearly we can make choices. That we are not going to be swayed just by arguments that seem to be able to convince us that we don't exist. And don't be too confident that people cannot make convincing arguments to show you that you don't exist. Can you prove that you exist? Maybe just sidetrack a little bit. Some may argue. You may have heard of this. I understand that a Chinese philosopher first came up with something like this. You dream that you're a butterfly. And in the dream, the you who is a butterfly dream that you are a man. And then, in that dream, the butterfly dreaming that he's a man, that man wakes up. And then he asks himself, am I a man or am I a butterfly? You get it? Now you may say, oh, I'm a man. I'm dreaming that I'm a butterfly. But in the dream, that butterfly is dreaming that he's a man. But then, in that dream, that man wakes up. But he's still in a dream. Now, after a while, if you pause in that kind of line of thinking, then when you're awake, you may ask yourself, am I a man who dreamt of a butterfly and now I've awakened? So I'm a man. Or is it that I'm actually a butterfly, but now I'm dreaming? I'm actually a butterfly, but I'm dreaming that I'm a man. So now I'm in a dream, so I think I'm a man, but actually I'm a butterfly. So actually, are you a butterfly or a man? So is it possible for someone to convince you that you're actually a butterfly? How do you prove that you are a man and not a butterfly? Which I'm a man, but maybe now you're dreaming. Well, I won't go further. But just end on this point, that this consciousness, that is true, sometimes in a dream it feels so real. But when you are awake right now, you know that it is reality. How to prove to you? Very difficult. But you know that this is not a dream. Now you are awake. You know, right? Well, if you don't know that now you are awake is serious, you may need treatment. But there is such a thing. And this has to do with how God has created us. Well, I won't go further, but I'm just saying that even if someone can come up with arguments that make you sound very confused, that make it very confusing and you wonder whether you exist or not, you can calmly come before the Lord, pray about it and say, yes, I'm satisfied, I exist. And I'm not going to be confused. So likewise, you before the Lord, as you pray about it, is it not clear that we can choose? And the choices that we make, we could have chosen otherwise, we can be very clear about it. And not only ourselves, that we are confused, something wrong with us. We can check with others. And others also have this consciousness. It's universal. And these are not weak arguments. They are actually very strong arguments as to ultimate reality and how God has actually created us. But now I want to go on to, as I said, we may believe it is, recognize it is so, we can make choices, we can choose other than what we have chosen, but we may not know how to account for it and how to counter the arguments put forward that we can't. That doesn't mean we cannot recognize it is so and believe in it. In fact, personally, I've been puzzled by this for several years. Though there is the clear conviction within me that men can definitely make moral choices and we can choose other than what we actually choose. That is clear to me. Along the lines I've mentioned to you, the consciousness is there, it's clear scriptural teaching, it's very clear. But how to account for it? How is it possible that we can choose other than what we actually choose? The arguments that seem to point that we, it's very, how to understand it? Whatever we choose, isn't it so there are reasons and so on? And if all these reasons are there, then we will choose that way. I think I can now explain how this can be so in a meaningful way consistent with the reality and the revelation in the scriptures. And I share with you my understanding of how there's a meaningful way, consistent with reality and revelation in the scriptures, to explain how it can be so. Your understanding of how it is feasible for us to make choices, to choose other than what we have chosen. And I make a statement and then I elaborate with various points. And the statement is that the I inverted commas, the I responds, chooses, makes the decision, and supplies moral input. The I, in the commas, responds, chooses, makes the decision, and supplies moral input in any response or choice of man that has a moral content. The I responds, chooses, makes the decision, and supplies moral input in any response or choice of man that has a moral content. As I go on, you'll see that God has created us with an I in each one of us. The I in inverted commas. So the first point is that we are conscious of this reality, of the I responding and making the decision. We know. Each one of us is I. I do this, I do that. I consider, I think, I choose. So we are conscious of this reality of the I responding. We are conscious of this I making decisions. Second point, God and the exhortations in the scriptures and so on, they all address the I in each one of us and urges us to respond and choose rightly. For example, God called Paul, at that time known as Saul, and then entrusted, appointed Paul as an apostle, and then Paul finally, at the end of his life, said, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. So God called him, God addressed him. He's addressing Paul, he's addressing the I in Paul. So each one of us, there is this reality of the I in each one of us. So likewise, when others speak to us, they address us, they encourage us, they urge us to respond, to choose, to act in a certain manner, they also address the I in each one of us. The fourth point, constitutional makeup, influences, environment, our past experiences, and our present context. This is the framework within which the I responds and chooses. The I can and does respond and choose. We are conscious of that and it is a reality. How the I responds and chooses is not fixed. There's a framework. And then the I responds and chooses. But how it responds and chooses, it is not fixed. In various situations of life, it is feasible for the I to respond in various ways and choose and decide on alternative courses of action available to the person in that context. We are conscious of it, and it is a reality. It is so. The fifth point, God has created us. And this fifth point, I will be elaborating more so that this whole subject can become clearer of what I'm trying to say. God has created us with this I, which can respond, make moral choices, unlike inanimate objects like stones, atoms and molecules and chemical reactions, which cannot choose and are subject to the physical and chemical laws ordained by God and the principle of cause and effect. The stones, inanimate objects, they do not have an I in them. And they are subject to the physical laws ordained by God, the principle of cause and effect. So it will happen this way, that way, and so on, unless God intervenes. But for the human being, it is different. This is at the heart of the meaning of man created in the image of God, with a capacity to make moral decisions. And this capacity to make moral decisions arises from the presence of the I. The capacity of the I to respond and to choose within our framework. Our response and conduct is not determined by our framework. Our conduct cannot be totally accounted for by cause and effect, unlike inanimate objects. If it were so, there wouldn't be the moral dimension in our lives, just like for stones, a chair. We cannot meaningfully talk about commending and rewarding a person for doing what is good, or condemning and punishing a person for doing what is evil, because there would be no moral input on his part. That is, if our lives are totally accounted by cause and effect, but it is not this way. We can meaningfully use these terms in the way the scriptures do. The scriptures do use these terms: reprimanding, condemning, praising, and so on. We can meaningfully use these terms in the way the scriptures do, and also in everyday life. We can meaningfully use these terms because the I supplies the moral input in any response and choice made which has a moral content. God has created us with this I, and this I gives, it supplies a moral input. It's not just cause and effect. It supplies the moral input. It's capable of supplying this input. And because of that, we will be held accountable for the moral input that comes from ourselves, the I in each one of us. So I'll summarize this part. Cause and effect does not fully explain man's response and conduct, and man can choose other than what he actually chooses because the I has the capacity, ability to supply moral input. That is the vital issue. The I, in each one of us, we have the capacity, we are created this way, the capacity and the ability to supply moral input. The reality of the I and its capacity for moral input in the way a person responds and chooses in any situation is the vital part of the total equation. It's the most important part of the equation. The moral input originates with the I. It is not caused. These moral inputs come from the I. It is not caused by other things, though the I can experience various influences. The I experiences various influences, yes. But the moral input comes from the I. It's not caused. It's not caused by other factors. But yes, other people and God may try to draw forth the positive. The evil one may try to draw us in a negative direction. But how we respond, the I supplies the moral input. Whether we respond positively or negatively, it comes from within ourselves, the I. It is because the moral input originates with us, we can and we will be held accountable for this moral input. See, the input that doesn't come from us, we will not be held accountable. You may be born with black hair. You are not held accountable for that. Morally responsible. You may even be born intelligent or not so lacking intelligence. You're born like that. You are not held accountable. There's no moral input. Suddenly somebody hits you without any moral failure on your part, and as a result, you have now become a handicapped person. There's no moral failure on your part because there's no moral input. Likewise, suddenly somebody give you a lot of money and you become now very rich. You can now buy many things, do many things with your money. you're coming into this money, if it's just suddenly given to you without any moral input on your part, again, it's not a moral issue. So whatever happens to you where there's no moral input on your part, there's no moral accountability. And this is consistent with the scriptural revelation. And Lord willing, in the future, I may look more into this with you, because it's a very important issue, the whole meaning of moral meaning in our hearts, and how we learn, how we grow, in what way and how God can be pleased with us, how we can grow well and participate well in God's, in the fulfillment of God's purposes and so on. All this revolves around moral meaning from our hearts, the moral input that comes from the eye. And we are created with this capacity to supply moral input to the situation that we are in. So the equation is not constitution plus influences, environment equals response, conduct, choice. This is not correct. As I mentioned, the I supplying the moral input is in fact the vital aspect, the vital part of the equation. Rather, is our constitution and influences and environment at any point in time, they are the framework within which we respond and choose at that point in time. The I respond and chooses within that framework. So our constitution and the influences, environment, at the point of conception, at the point of birth and so on, where we have no choice, that is not our responsibility. And we will not be held accountable. On the other hand, let us also bear in mind, even our constitution and the influences and the environment that we have is not static, but dynamic. And not only is not static and dynamic, to some degree, we even have a say as to our constitution and the influences environment. I want to emphasize this point. Maybe another time I may elaborate more on this. It's because we cannot just attribute everything to of constitution, influences, environment as beyond our responsibility. It's not so. You can refer to the messages on framework within which we work out our lives. AR029 and AR030. Some are fixed, and the person concerned has no say. So for example, our biological parents is fixed. We have no say. Our country of birth, our constitutional makeup at birth, at conception, at birth, yes, we have no say. But there are various aspects that are dynamic. Our constitution is actually dynamic after we are born. It continues to be dynamic throughout our lives. Our physical health is a dynamic thing. Our friends, our working environment, the experiences we go through, all these are dynamic. And to some degree, I say to some degree because it's not absolute. I'll explain a little bit and then I want to move on. To some degree, we have a say, but there are aspects we have no say which are beyond our control. So for example, our physical health is dynamic and to some degree we have a say. Some aspects we don't have a say because it comes from our birth. But whether we take care of our health, the food we eat, exercises and so on, this can affect our physical health. So it is not totally, we have no say. Likewise, our friends. To some degree, we have a say, but it's not absolute. While we are in, for example, you're in a certain context, then that is your framework, who you choose, but they're still limited. But if you're in another country, it's again a different context. So to some degree, we have a say. Likewise, the experiences we go through, it's not absolute, we have absolute say, because something just happened to us. We do not choose that, but it happens. You can be driving on the road, you don't choose an accident, you've been careful, and so somebody hits you. You experience it. But we have a say. For example, how careful you are can make a difference as to how many accidents you get and how likely you'll get an accident, and so on. So, it is not absolute that we have a say, but it's also not that we have no say at all in various of these aspects of environment, influences, and so on. Even so, where we get our influences from, the friends that we choose, and so the context we frequent, all this will make a difference as to the influences that come our way. So we have a responsibility to the degree we have a say. And we have responsibility how we respond and choose within the framework we are in. God looks at the moral meaning of our response within the framework at that point in time, and the moral meaning of our response in turn has a direct bearing on the development of our moral being. Some of these areas, to be clearer, will need further elaboration, perhaps in a subsequent message. The sixth point, this I that I'm referring to includes the self-consciousness. We have self-consciousness that we exist, for example, it's part of the I. This I includes the self-consciousness and the consciousness that we can think, analyze, respond, and make choices. The I has all these qualities. It can think, it can choose, it has a self-consciousness. Seven point. Man, with this I that I'm talking about, and this self-consciousness, it's not merely a useful concept, a hypothesis, a proposition, a notion, an idea. It is a reality. We actually have this I within each one of us, with this self-consciousness. The eighth point. The I in each one of us is a continuum. It continues. This is an important aspect of how God has created us. Meaning, we have a history, a past, a present, a future. And the present and the future I can be held accountable for our past conduct and response because it's the same I. I'll come to afterwards, our essential being, our identity. The ninth point, all our lives, conduct, moral meaning in our hearts and moral responses and choices made will continually affect this I and its development. And this I, which is our essential being. The I in each one of us is inextricably bound up with our identity. That means it goes together, it's bound together. It is our identity, bound up with our identity and our existence as an individual. So two different persons, it is not mixed up. They have their separate identities. Well, if you ponder further, you may wonder, what about all these transplants that are going on? Somebody's eye now become your eye, somebody's hand become your hand, and so on. Then how? Does it then become half that person, half you? No. Where these parts that come to you are just physical parts, the eye is still the eye. But now, yes, you have a hand that originally belongs to somebody else. But the eye in each one of us continues. So the eye is inextricably bound up with our identity, our existence as an individual, and we will in the end stand before God, judged by God, accountable for this continuum, that all the choices that we have made, all that we have gone through, how we have responded. The 10th point, the next few points I will go through very quickly, just to complete the picture. The most important aspect of the I is the moral quality of the being. 11th point, the moral input in the responses and choices made continually affect and contribute to the quality and meaning of our being. The moral, spiritual stature of the I, the quality of our life. When you say a man has moral, spiritual stature, there's quality in his life, what does it mean? It's not so much what he's born with, his constitution at birth, and his surrounding circumstances. It has to do with the moral input, the moral response, moral input, all along the way, as he responds to God, God's calling, Spirit of God at work in his life, to what degree he responds, rejects the powers, darkness, the evil influences, to what degree he responds positively to the Spirit of God at work and positive influences in his life, and so on. 12th point, the quality of our being our moral spiritual stature is what God is primarily concerned about in our lives, and what we ought to be primarily concerned about. So let us not lament about those aspects that we can't help. How we were when we came to this earth, like conception at birth and so on, and all kinds of influences that come our way which we can't help, we can't do anything about them. But let us be very concerned about what we can help, because that is our moral input, and that will determine our moral spiritual stature. And that is what God is primarily concerned about. That is what we ought to be primarily concerned about. That is has to do with the quality of our being, the quality of life. 13 point. The quality of our being will then have a direct bearing on the meaning and quality of fellowship with God and with the brethren, and also the meaning and manner of our participation in the fulfillment of God's purposes. If we want to participate meaningfully in God's purposes, then we need to respond well to God and the moral spiritual meaning in our hearts develops, the moral spiritual stature of the eye develops. The 14th point. This quality of our being continues on in the age to come and has a direct bearing on the quality and meaning of our fellowship with God and with the brethren and the meaning of our time in eternity. It carries on in eternity. And also how we continue to participate in the outworking of God's purposes in eternity. So not just during our time on earth, it carries on. And that helps us to appreciate its significance. I want to now make some concluding remarks on how we can respond to the earlier arguments on cause and effect and the reasons for choices we make, which seems to point in the direction that we will not choose other than what we actually choose because of the reasons for our choices and so on, and that the ability to choose other than what we actually choose is an illusion. Some concluding remarks on how we respond to that line of thinking and arguments along those directions. First point is that human response and conduct and the way man chooses cannot be accounted for merely by the principle of cause and effect. I say merely because, yes, there are certain aspects that do influence us, but it cannot be merely accounted for by that. In the same way, this is reflected in the manner in which the laws of nature, the laws of physics and chemistry operates in relation to inanimate objects and matter. Yes, inanimate objects and matter, they are subjected to cause and effect, the laws of physics and chemistry, and it will move in those ways, cause and effect. The principles apply, laws and physics, laws of physics and chemistry. But for man, and how man chooses and so on, it cannot be merely accounted for by the principle of cause and effect, laws of physics and chemistry. We cannot say our choices are the result of various factors which cause us to make those choices. Our choices are not the result of various factors which cause us to make those choices. We cannot say that. Rather, at any point in time, there are various factors and influences in the total framework within which we, or the I, make the choices. But these factors and influences do not determine our choices. They don't determine. They influence. They are just a framework within which we make our choices, we respond. The I in each one of us contributes a moral input in all moral response and choices made, which gives it its moral meaning. There's a framework, and then the I provides the moral input, and it is this moral input that gives it its moral meaning. Our conduct, our response in any situation, there's moral meaning, is because of the moral input of the I in the situation. The second point has to do with the argument along the reasons for our choices. We can say There are reasons why we finally choose in a certain way. It is true. There's nothing wrong with that statement, actually. There are reasons why we finally choose in a certain way. But this does not mean we could not have chosen differently. There are alternative causes of action we can choose, and there are reasons for whatever course of action we finally embark upon. See, the earlier line argument is that there are reasons why you choose. So because of those reasons, you will choose that way. In reality, it is possible to choose differently. There are alternative course of action, and whichever course of action we take, there are reasons for it. I explain further what I mean. In reality, in our consideration of which course of action to embark upon, we may experience various influences and thoughts pulling us in different directions. For example, God and the truth we have come to recognize and the encouragement of the brethren draws us in the direction of doing what is right and pleasing to God. But the attractions of the world, the desires of the flesh, and the evil one draws us in the negative direction. We can choose what is pleasing to God. And if we do so, we can say there are reasons for us to do so. So at times, a believer chooses what is pleasing to God, and you can say there are reasons why he has chosen what is pleasing to God. There are reasons for it. On the other hand, we can also choose to do what is displeasing to God. We disobey God. But it's not without reason. There are reasons. We can choose to do what is displeasing to God, and we do so, we can also say there are reasons why we do so. There are these attractions, these temptations, and we give in to it. There are reasons. But the fact that there are reasons for the course of action we embark upon does not mean we cannot choose a different course of action. And if we choose the other course of action, there are also reasons for it. However, it's also helpful to have a more complete understanding of this issue. It's correct to say that though we can choose to do other than what we actually choose, and when a person sins against God, it is feasible for him to choose otherwise. It is not always easy to do so. Not only that, it is also true that in various situations, we can say it is likely, or even very, very likely, almost certain, but not absolute, can say very likely, for a particular person, at that point in time, to respond and choose in a certain way. For example, if a person is spiritually weak, the temptation is strong, and he has been giving in to that area of temptation in the past, and even now he lacks the determination and the resolve to overcome the temptation, we can say he's very likely to falter. Almost certainly he will give in to the temptation. He will falter. In contrast, another who is relatively spiritually strong, the temptation he's facing is mild. He has been overcoming that area of temptation. He is prayerful and he's walking well with the Lord. He's not presumptuous. He's vigilant and prayerful. We can say he's very likely not to succumb to that temptation. Now, I give this to indicate that constitutional makeup, influences, environment, and so on, it does have a bearing on the choices that we make. It's not that it has no bearing, but some of this we may need to look into more carefully if we want to understand more accurately what all these things mean and the meaning of the moral input and so on. But that is more complex. Maybe another time we may go into this. But having said the above, I still see it needful to make this observation that the outcome where it involves moral issues is not fixed. I mentioned you are spiritually weak, temptation strong, and so on. The likelihood of failure Likewise, if you're spiritually strong, temptation is mild, you're prayerful, you're likely to overcome. But outcome is not fixed. We can choose other than what we actually choose. And the moral input and response of a person in the circumstances of life is variable and dynamic. And a person can change for the better or for the worse. You see, just now I mentioned the person is spiritually weak, the temptation is strong. He has been giving in to that area of temptation. But I also mentioned he lacks determination and resolve to overcome. So, very likely he will falter. But this determination to resolve and to overcome is variable. For example, God can be speaking to him, encouraging him, and if he responds positively to God, or in his heart he cries out to God, which he can, because he wants to overcome, then God can help him. Then it's no longer so clear that he will falter. So, it is a variable thing, if in our hearts we really want to overcome. But that doesn't mean past failures and so on is not relevant. Temptations being strong, not relevant. All those are relevant. Likewise, a person may be relatively spiritually stronger, but if he's presumptuous, careless, then he can falter. But I mentioned just now, he's spiritually strong, he has been overcoming, and he's prayerful, vigilant, walking well with God. The prayerful vigilance is already a moral input. When we are prayerful, we are vigilant, it's a moral response in our heart that needs to be maintained. It's a dynamic thing. It's not fixed. It can change. And it is the eye who supplies that. But not on its own. It's in the context of God's provision. First, God has created us with this capacity. Then, the Spirit of God at work to draw us, to encourage us, to help us. In that context, we can respond positively. In the direction of God's call and what God desires of us. But the eye needs to respond positively to God and to reject the temptations of the world, the temptations of the evil one. And how the eye is going to respond is a dynamic thing. What determines it? The eye. We determine it. We choose to respond positively to God, or we choose to give in to the temptation of the evil one. When God created Adam and Eve, placed them in the Garden of Eden, when the evil one tempted Eve, the way God has created her was, God said, very good. Created, understood what is right and wrong, the conscience functioning very well, can recognize right and wrong, all the provisions are there. She could have responded positively to God, but she could also yield to the temptation of the evil one. And when she yielded to the temptation of the evil one, it is not because she couldn't possibly obey the Lord. She could have. God wanted her to obey, and God had made the provision, and she could. There are several scriptural passages that are referred to in the last message to show that man has the capacity to make moral choices, that this is a clear teaching and revelation in the scriptures. Many of them are relevant to show we can choose other than what we actually choose. I think time is now late. I will just mention the verses to you, and if suitable, the next session I may comment a little bit, but I don't think I want to take further time. I referred to you several passages, in particular Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 to 20. Then Mark chapter 1 verse 15, John chapter 5 verse 40, Ezekiel chapter 18 verse 32, Acts 17 verse 30, Acts 7 verse 51, Luke chapter 7 verse 30. If you look at those verses, you'll see that they do have relevance in showing that we can choose other than what we actually choose. And in addition, the Lord willing, perhaps the next message I will comment on Isaiah chapter 5 verses 1 to 7 and Hebrews chapter 3 verses 7 to 11, which shows to us that the scriptural revelation does include this aspect that we can choose other than what we actually choose. I'll stop here for today.